Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced by WEKU and Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. This week, new music from Lexington recording artist Jim Gleason, a display at the Lexington History Museum that will change the way you see the city as you drive around town, how storytelling and humor can bring us together, and the backstory on the Lexington Opera House about to celebrate its 140th year. First, David Brancaccio has stepped away from hosting Marketplace Morning Report after 13 years and has moved into a new role as Marketplace Special Correspondent. This new assignment is to focus on the future effects of present-day economic decisions. I talked with David about this move from Marketplace host to Special Correspondent. David Brancaccio, we really appreciate you taking time for us.
It's really fun to be here.
You've helped listeners, us, make sense of the economy in real time for a lot of years now. Why was this the right moment to step away from daily hosting and take on this new correspondent role?
It's never quite the right time, right? You take a look at the news flow, and every time you anticipate stepping back, there's a giant news story. And of course, we all have a lot on our plates now with the headlines that are coming in these days. It was a former Washington State Governor, Booth Gardner, who said that we should change it up about every 7 years. and he went eight until I think he was term limited out of that governor's spot. So, you know, close enough for him. I've been doing the morning show specifically, which in my time zone, Pacific time, is an alarm clock that goes off at 2 a.m. I've been doing it for 13 years.
Ouch.
That's coming up on, twice as long as one should. I love it. I got a great team. Not just saying that. It's a fabulous bunch. And I'm going to miss working with them directly. But, you know, I'm staying at Marketplace. It's a new beat. But I'm just going to, I think, try to turn into a normal human being where I can do things on weekday nights where I'm not feeling jet lagged on the weekend. Look, I know, Tom, it was the best job in broadcasting that I'm leaving. But we'll try to make the new one also a good one. We also had some added challenges. We're doing fine, but I mean, you may have heard in those big California wildfires over a year ago, we had just bought a new house a couple of months prior to the fire, and it burned down.
Oh.
We're fine. We got a plan. We actually broke ground last week on what could be the rebuild. We're optimistic. But I'll tell you what, that takes a lot of energy. It's like my wife and I have each been thrust into a master's program in construction and in insurance and all that stuff. And so doing it on 4 hours of sleep, fairly demanding job. I'm not digging ditches, but you know, you got to focus, right?
Mm-hmm.
and also the rebuild, it's hard to do on 4 hours of sleep. So it's one of the other motivations.
Well, what can this assignment let you do that being a daily host and those early hours and so forth does not let you do?
I'm sort of making amends in the new capacity. We've tried to always bring context to our coverage. However, covering headlines of the past 12 hours and covering markets moment to moment encourages, I think, too much short-term thinking. I mean, look, let's face it. If the NASDAQ is up 0.2% this hour, that doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Now, I know the reason that a lot of people want me to continue doing the Dow and the S&P and the NASDAQ is because they regard it as a readout of the health of the nation at the moment. Now, I would caution people against using it that way, but that is how those numbers are sometimes regarded. Can you conclude that if the Dow is up 12 points, that the country is in good hands and is safely on the correct course and so forth? I'm not quite sure that's true, but that is how we're used it. But that's a lot of short-term thinking. We also focus on quarterly profit reports sometimes on our program and economic statistics that come out every 3 months. And I'll tell you what, that can lead us astray from making wiser decisions that take into account what happens downstream. This could be government policy. This could be personal finance. We humans are terrible at thinking beyond 2 weeks from now. I know maybe there's a saver in your life. You bump into them from time to time who are really good at, when the paycheck comes in, setting some aside for someday. That's what we encourage. But many of us are poor at it. It has a fancy pants economic name. It's called hyperbolic discounting. And there are actually remedies for it. There are ways we can train ourselves to think longer term. And you would hope the powers that be running our companies would also think beyond the stock price tonight or the earnings call in 3 months, but they don't. And a lot of bad things flow from that. And I think this new beat will allow me to really take people on journeys, you know, with good storytelling that explore some of these issues.
How do you plan to keep long-range reporting concrete and human rather than abstract?
I'm not going to be doing a lot of speculative coverage on what the future might hold. It's more stuff that's in front of us right now that we have to start thinking about. Another part of this beat is, I don't know what brought you into your career here, but from a very early age, I knew I wanted to be in radio with a huge passion. That is a gift. How do young people look out for the spark that will guide their destiny? How do they keep ill-informed parents or knuckleheaded peers, or even sometimes you run into the wrong guidance counselor, from drumming it out of you, the thing that you're passionate about? That could be part of my future effects beat. That may lend itself more to short video, but it's among the fun things that we're thinking about.
Would you say that this role is going to give you more room to follow the human impact of policy, business, and technology decisions over time? I mean, that seems to be what you're saying with regard to AI, which is really a very short-term future. It's coming on rather quickly, isn't it?
It's coming on very, very quickly. I've been interested for a long time in this question, which is, look, even the AI companies are calling for regulation and guardrails. I'm aware that the administration in Washington right now is, its general posture toward this is hands off, let the industry try to flourish. But some guardrails are probably going to have to go up. Who's at the table deciding those? Should it just be, and I love them, software engineers? Should it be philosophers, people with a sense of history, sociologists who know about the effects of public policy, economists? In other words, who is part of the dialogue on our AI future? And I'm always interested in making sure that people from all walks of life are part of that discussion, not just, and again, I say it with affection, the engineers, particularly the software engineers, who sometimes may not have the wider perspective that we need to make smart decisions about this life-changing technology.
You've been quoted, David, as saying that short-term thinking drives many bad money decisions at the personal, the corporate policy levels. What have you seen over the years that convinced you of that?
I mean, you see it right and left in our own lives. It's in fact, you know, if you and I and everyone listening did this exercise, what is the issue that underlies all issues? Well, some might say money for education. That's a good one. Some might say money in politics, right? In other words, if we were to fix that system, would a lot of other things fall into line? I think there is an argument that short-term thinking underlies so many of our poor decisions. I mean, you might be thinking about the environment. Let's just dump our junk out behind the factories, and probably no one's ever going to see it. That isn't a good idea. Someone's going to see it in the long run, and it's going to come back to bite you. Now, the author Kurt Vonnegut, before he passed away, I did a PBS interview with him. It was a great, amazing opportunity for me to meet the great man, the great social critic and writer himself. And he looks at me in this interview, and he says, what no country, he said in his gruff voice, what no country's ever had is a secretary of the future. And there, he said, no plans for our children and grandchildren. And, you know, what he's talking about is who in power is thinking about how something we're doing now can come back to bite us. And sometimes that's been framed with the word sustainability, which often is very focused on environmental sustainability, but it can be sustainability of a business. If a business does the right thing longer term, it would tend to minimize the dangerous stuff it does and negative impacts on communities and the environment around it. So we've been joking around a little bit. Maybe I should call myself in this new role a sleuth for consequences, right? We have to be thinking about it. We're doing something that seems like a really good idea for the next 2 weeks. Does it blow up in our face down the line? There are some companies that have these secretaries of the future. They don't call them that. They call them often chief sustainability officers. It doesn't just have to be, although that's crucial, environmental sustainability. I mean, are we making a chemical that has unknown health effects? And when the data comes in on this chemical, are we going to get sued out of existence? That's an interesting long-term view type of question that companies can wrestle with. So the ones that have chief sustainability officers, and here's the crucial thing, Tom, that also have the ear of the CEO, right? So it's not just window dressing. A person with power and connections to the people really making the decisions. That can be a great safeguard for companies so that they are still existing in 4, 5, 10 years because of the decision they make now.
I want to switch gears just a little bit, David. You've had a remarkable career, and that includes your work with Bill Moyers on the PBS program Now. Bill Moyers went from local journalism in Texas and Austin to White House press secretary during the Johnson years to eventually becoming what I believe to have been one of the most thoughtful, thought-provoking journalists out there. What was it like to work with Bill Moyers?
What an honor that was. I went from Marketplace to that Friday evening show Now with Bill Moyers in 2003. And then when he retired, I became the sole anchor of that show. You know, the public image of Bill Moyers is what you got when you worked with him shoulder to shoulder. The depths of wisdom, or the heights of wisdom, I should say. He just had this encyclopedic knowledge of things and an almost photographic memory. And I had been reading up on the Johnson administration. Probably a good idea if you don't work for Bill Moyers, right? He's reading up on the Johnson administration, reading the Robert Caro books. And there was this story that was repeated in multiple sources that I had read over the years about Johnson. And it was the night that Congress approved the bill that was the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And it is arguably the most important piece of domestic policy legislation of the 1960s. I think there's a good argument there. And the president, Johnson, is depicted in bed, morose about this. And someone goes in there and says, you know, what's the problem, Mr. President, or words to that effect. And apparently Johnson says, I'm just worried that we being the Democrats have handed the South over to the Republicans for the next generation. This is this famous quote. I go into Bill Moyers one day. I didn't really bug him too much about history, but I was like, who's the source? Who goes into the president of the United States' bedroom?
I was going to ask.
And I don't know to this day who it was, but Bill got this big smile on his face, and I think it was him. And he said to me, I remember him saying, he goes, you know, well, the president was there in bed, and he had the covers pulled up to his nose the way he did. And I'm thinking to myself, yes, good old Johnson. Of course, we know how he uses his bed covers at night. You know, obviously, I'm talking to a man with amazing access. He was incredible, and I will tell you part of the secret to his long-term success was Mrs. Moyers, Judith Moyers, his executive editor. She was also a really important component of that show, and I'll tell you exactly to answer your question, what it was like working for Now on PBS with Bill Moyers. You know the TV show The West Wing? It was the journalism version of that. I mean, I was kind of an outlier, probably not all that smart, but everyone else was fully briefed, and you'd walk down the halls where we produced the show out of New York, having these, you know, important policy conversations about redistricting, gerrymandering, and campaign finance reform ahead of doing these long pieces on Friday night. So it was a wonderful opportunity for me to just kind of learn from people and to do, I think, some pretty good work. I think that program was what TV journalism should be. You know, we didn't do fluff, and I think there's room for you know, hard-hitting journalism on television, fact-based. I think we need more of it rather than less.
Thank you so much for sharing that. So back to this new role that you're in now. After so many years of helping people understand what the economy is doing now, today, what are you most eager to learn by asking what today will mean tomorrow?
I'm interested in economic inequality. and how policies and opportunities and emerging business innovations, who wins and who loses, and does it widen the gap between rich and poor? And I was reminded of the importance of applying this prism of thinking about inequality to what will happen in our future when I was in Flagstaff, Arizona, a couple weeks ago. It is the 100th anniversary of old historic Route 66 from Chicago out to Southern California, route of one of the great migrations during the Dust Bowl, for instance. It's a kind of fun, kitschy place now if you've not been on it. A lot of cool old-timey diners and motels that have a lot of neon and different smells, I will tell you, after spending many nights in them on this trip recently. But I end up in Flagstaff, where there's a university called Northern Arizona University with a very dynamic president. And they have declared this year the year of AI empowerment on campus and for the wider community. And some of it is offering courses in AI. I mean, that's what people want to be able to have careers that are aligned with that. But it's also inviting students to ask tough questions about this new technology. And one of them is, will humans become subservient to the technology? Or will AI technology serve humans? It's about empowerment and sovereignty. You know, often when new technologies come on board, it widens the gap between rich and poor, and then maybe over time it would narrow it again. But how do you think about those questions about who wins and who loses when you see these momentous changes? So that's going to be a really important guiding question for me as I do this stuff. And I don't know, Tom, your life, but I now have my first grandkid, a 14-month-old who's in Northern California, a delight, a charismatic, amazing delight, who's just learned to walk. And I know some of this is guided by, what are we foisting on that young man? Mm-hmm. What are we delivering him? Is he paying for my lower taxes right now? Recently, the Trump administration issued its budget proposal that Congress would have to consider, because, of course, Congress is the appropriator here. And it has, for instance, a major focus, as we've reported, on military spending. But the administration is not doing the usual detailed costing over time of its budget. And I'll be very interested in the history of that and how these things have been costed by, say, the Congressional Budget Office in years past. What are the methodologies? To what extent can we rely upon those? And what do we miss if we don't do that kind of costing? Because if you want to just bring it down to brass tacks, are we going to be spending on stuff in this coming year that this little 14-month-old has to pay off with his higher taxes when he becomes a working adult? I think that's, an interesting ongoing question.
Well, as a grandfather, I can say that I'm grateful that there is now somebody who's going to be looking at that, because I think it's a concern for everybody who has grandchildren who are very worried about what the future looks like for them.
Tom, I'm an optimistic person, but there are multiple institutes studying existential threats in this country and around the world with grown-up researchers. We highlighted them on Marketplace recently in a little series I did. Existential threats, meaning stuff that if we get it wrong means there are no longer humans and civilization. It's a serious question. And so I think as we help people delve deeper into the stakes of all this, I think that'll give them added information that can help them participate in some of the solutions.
That's David Brancaccio. He's moving into the role of special correspondent at Marketplace, focusing on the long-term future effects of present-day economic decisions. Thank you so much, David.
It's been my pleasure.
In this 250th anniversary year of the nation's founding, a historic Lexington performance venue is getting ready to celebrate its 140th year. And were it not for our guest's determination, that would not be happening. Joining us by phone from Florida is Linda Carey, herself a performer and artist who, along with Lexington businessman and philanthropist W.T. Young, saved the Opera House from the wrecking ball. Thanks for joining us, Linda.
pleasure to be here.
So the Opera House was getting ready to celebrate its 140th birthday. That's coming up in May. But if you would tell us about how it looked when they were just about to tear it down 50 years ago.
Well, it was pretty disastrous. I had never been there. I'd heard about it because my husband used to get on the bus and go downtown to go to the theater to see it, what they call B-movies. And he told me he always held his feet up because of the rats that ran around.
Ooh.
So that was the state of it. And I actually don't even remember going down Broadway and looking and seeing it. I remember going to the Ben Ally as a student at UK. But when it was about to be torn down, and when I realized that that was going to happen and that there was not actually space on the plot that was where the Lexington Center was going to be for any kind of a theater, that was really why it caught my eye, I think. And it was just a small blurb in the newspaper, probably about an inch high, and said that the Opera House had been condemned by the fire marshal and would soon be torn down. So I quickly called some people that I knew vaguely in the theater world, and we went down and got a little tour, which was not much. We walked up the stairs, which were very rickety, and could look down over the false ceiling that had been installed probably 30 years before to keep the heat and the debris from the pigeons who could fly in and out off the audience downstairs. And we saw what remained of the proscenium arch and also the plaster decoration that's over the boxes. Some of that was left. And I realized, all of us did when we saw the boxes, that this really was a bona fide theater. So that's what it was. Pigeons were flying. And of course, then after the board of the Lexington Center had decided we would purchase it, then the roof fell in.
I mentioned that the Opera House dates back to about 1886, and some pretty remarkable things have happened on that stage. For example, there was a production of Henley Regatta, and in that one, they flooded the stage, and most of the performance took place in rowboats. And I think there was a production of Ben-Hur.
Yes, Ben-Hur was a very notable play that went around the country because of the chariot race. And of course, we all remember that from the DeMille movie. But John Jacob Niles told me in person in an interview that I did with him that he was one of the kids, he was probably around 12, 14, who they hired just to pull the ropes that made the circle on the stage go round and round. And so they had two chariots and two horses who stood perfectly still. And the faster that the young boys could pull the rope, the faster the horses appeared to turn. So I would think it was kind of like one of those old-fashioned flip comics that you could flip and it looked like something was moving.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, that was documented that it actually occurred there. So, and then when the roof fell in, somebody very enterprising snuck in at some point and scraped off some of the posters that I saw with my small committee that were on the brick wall backstage. And there was the five Coens. There was Helen Hayes as a child.
Mm.
There were two or three other circus-type posters. There was one for Houdini. And then there were flyers that we found that Thomas Edison actually appeared, because when he went from gas to electric, he went around the country to demonstrate what that could do. So we know that he actually appeared there also.
Just amazing. Well, what would you like for people who are listening to us to know about the Opera House Fund, its 50-year history of supporting the arts?
The fund is very unique. We didn't think about that when it was founded, that this was one of the more unique supporters of the arts in the country. But someone said not long ago, it's just such an unusual model. It was because I had been a performer locally, and I knew how difficult it was for an organization, whether it was musical theater or the Lexington Singers or the Philharmonic, to find a place to perform that they could actually afford. And we had many people who were questioning when the Opera House was beginning to come alive again, if the rental would be for free. And we made a decision that absolutely not. But in order to encourage local arts groups to use the theater, we would raise enough money to accomplish our goal, which was number one, to create the porte cochere that's on Short Street, so there would be a better, more efficient entrance. And the second one was to provide a subsidy for local arts that would use the Opera House. And then the third was to provide against loss, because we knew we had a relatively small theater, to start bringing touring companies of live theater to Lexington. So I guess it was just the fact that everybody knew how difficult it was to last as an arts group, or at least Bill and I made them understand how difficult it was. And we said, we've got to raise money to help them. And at first, we made it a criteria that they had to belong to the Council of the Arts, which has become LexArts. And that the idea was that they would more or less vet the organization to look at their finances to see what kind of fundraising they did. And if they felt that they were a legitimate organization, then they would pass them on to the Opera House Fund if they wanted to perform there. Of course, things have evolved over time. The process is not that any longer and hasn't been for quite a while. But it is a unique thing. Once we raised the money to accomplish the first goal, then we continued to raise money and invest it so that we could achieve the other two goals. Over the years, we have distributed $15.7 million to local arts groups, the Lexington Center for Broadway Live and Variety Live, and to also upgrade the building of the Opera House in the interior.
Kind of switching gears here just a little bit, how have you seen the performing arts landscape in Lexington grow and change over these 50 years?
Well, I have seen some grow, some fall by the wayside. A problem with local arts groups is generally that they not only have to raise money, but they also have changing boards and changing leadership. And I think that's too bad. And as a result, sometimes things aren't as they would appear, just because you're changing every 2 years or every 4 years or whatever. And as a result, you don't have that impassioned feeling of someone on your board that they're going to keep things going. And then it becomes also a public perception that because this organization exists, they have an endowment of some kind. The Lexington Singers is an example of that. They don't have an endowment. The Philharmonic is struggling right now with fundraising. They have a small endowment, but, you know, you've really got to have somebody on your team that understands what your needs are going to be in the future, not just what your needs are for that current performance or current year.
There's an event coming up in May happening at the Opera House. It's called Bravo, and full disclosure for anybody who's heard it, that is my voice doing the ad as a public service. How did Bravo come about?
Well, we felt that we needed to let the public know. You know, we've gone through, what, three generations now of attendees at the Opera House. So when I go, often I'll hear people in the back say, oh, isn't this beautiful? Wonder when they did this. Or, gosh, I've never been here before. So we felt as the fund we needed to make the general public more aware of where we were, where we came from, and what we do. So there's a whole week of celebrating, and I'm particularly excited about the opening premiere event because it's on Mother's Day. And who could be better than Bernadette Peters, who has been actually the muse of Stephen Sondheim. And her show is just wonderful. It's not just musical theater. It's jazz. It's ballads. And I'm acquainted with several people who have seen her perform as a solo artist, and they say she's just fabulous. So I'm really excited about that. And then we will be also spotlighting local arts groups. That will be on Wednesday the 13th. They will all be groups that have an arts education aspect as part of their mission. And then on Friday evening, the 15th, the Lexington Philharmonic will join with the Lexington Singers, and they both performed at the opening week of the Opera House when it first opened in 1976. So they're going to be doing a beautiful new work that the Singers performed at Carnegie Hall and also at David Geffen Hall in New York. And featured guest artist will be Tessa Lark, who is actually, I think, from Richmond, and she's a violinist, and she'll be doing a piece that had its beginnings with the bluegrass. So we think we have a varied program. I'm really excited about it. I'm just very happy that I've lived long enough to see this anniversary, and I'm so grateful to all the staff and the people who have put it together. And you, Tom, you've been so generous with your public service announcements over the years, with Broadway Live and the Opera House series. So I'm excited about it and grateful.
Well, thank you very much. And one question. I understand that for Bernadette Peters, this is a one-off. It's not as though she's on tour and just happened to put Lexington on her tour itinerary. She's coming here specially for this. Is that correct?
Yes, that is very true. And we were thrilled that she was available and willing and so interested in the fact that we're celebrating this anniversary.
Well, how can the public support this?
Buy tickets.
All right. That is Linda Carey, who had the vision to save the Lexington Opera House from demolition a half century ago. And we certainly thank you, Linda.
Thank you, Tom.
You can find all the information about the Opera House Celebration Week online at centralbankcenter.com. Click on the Opera House logo in the menu at the top of the page. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard. Paul Strickland is a Kentucky storyteller and musician known for mixing humor, live storytelling, and guitar. And he's one of the featured performers at the Paris Storytelling Festival coming up on May 8th through 10th. Paul, thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
For listeners who might not know your work, how would you describe what you do on stage?
So I am a professional full-time touring storyteller. I travel all around the United States and Canada year-round, telling stories. I'm primarily known as a fictionalist. Like, I tell stories that are made up. So either I tell stories that I collect from my family, who are known as my aunt True and my uncle False, or I tell tall tales from other worlds, or I tell what I like to call reupholstered folk tales, which are folk tales and fairy tales that I take pieces and parts of from different versions of that same story, put them together, and then reupholster them for contemporary audiences to sit comfortably in.
So humor is a big part of your work. And I'm wondering,
yes, sir,
what does that open up in a story?
I think that humor has so many more functions than just entertainment. Obviously, it is entertaining, but you know, when a group of people laugh together, it is the literal act of community. They are all letting out an audible vote for the fact that they are in that same room together. The other thing I think that's super important about humor, in kind of a Mark Twain level, is that laughter is, in my opinion, actually the sound of ideas settling into place. So when you're telling a story, especially like the kind of stories that I tell, which are fictional, which are often surreal or a little absurd, when you're getting those laughs, not only are people having the sort of nervous system, positive dopamine giving response of the good feeling of that laughter, and not only are they voting to be together as a community group in that moment, the other thing that's happening, though, is that they are able to sort of process this new experience in a positive way. And in my experience of traveling around and telling stories in retirement communities, as well as elementary schools, sometimes in the same 24 hours, it doesn't matter what age group you're talking to or what social group you're talking to. When people have the opportunity to be in a room together, experiencing the same thing in their own individual way, there's something really magical that happens that is uniquely human, and I think is the work of storytelling today.
What is it like for you when you're on stage and you get that organic connection through laughter, when you feel the room getting what you're doing?
It depends on what I'm trying to do with that laugh in the middle of the story. How does that laugh function in the story? So sometimes I'm just trying to get a laugh to let people know, hey, this is going to be fun, you know? And sometimes it is. I'll tell a lot of those stories in Paris coming up, and you'll hear from Donald Davis, who's one of the greatest storytellers of our time. Donald will be there. And one of the things that Donald does that's so beautiful is that Donald really settles the audience into a place where they are comfortable with their own nostalgia. So one of the things that I'm doing with a laugh is I'm trying to make room for the audience to be willing to look at the world from a slightly skewed perspective. So when I'm making the audience comfortable with a laugh, a lot of times it is buying their attention for something that they might not be as comfortable buying their attention for otherwise.
You've performed a lot of places, comedy clubs, schools, prisons, major festivals. Mm-hmm. So given what you just said, how much do you shape the performance that you're going to put on around the audience in front of you?
Entirely. The story is the story, but every time I tell a story, it is a little different based on who's in front of me, because every story, in my opinion, if it is well told, is a conversation. I am gauging if the audience understands and at what point they understand. I am gauging where the audience is reacting to something. And based on how quickly they react to something, I will tell a part of the story a little differently moving forward. Because the key to this is that I am creating and maintaining a moment of community. So if I let the story be more important than that moment of community, I don't feel like I'm doing my job. I think that the story itself is what we are gathering around. And that gathering, that mental gathering, is what is the most valuable thing.
I don't want to bring any of this into this conversation, but in the moment that we're in, and that's all I'll say about it, is a time when community feels so especially important. And storytelling has a way, as you're describing, of creating community. And I'm wondering, for somebody who's never been to a storytelling festival, what do you hope they discover by hearing this art form live for the first time?
I hope that people come because I know that they will have the experience of sitting in a room or in under a tent alongside of and in fellowship with people that they do not agree with. That is what I know will happen. And what I know will happen is that when they sit in that room or in that tent in fellowship with people they don't agree with, they will hear a story and they may have a different response in their bodies than the people sitting next to them. And when that happens, what it does is it opens up the possibility for more communion through communication. I think that storytelling is a great way for people to come together who may not agree with one another all the time. But as my Uncle Faltz often says, that don't mean we can't get together, learn to love each other, and still get along. Stories have been the way that we transmit community for centuries. And the truth is, not everybody is going to ever agree. The truth is, we have always lived in a time that is in some way, shape, or form divisive. But the fact is, the story of our shared humanity is something that has survived. And because it has survived, that is a great reason to be focusing on hearing those stories and telling those stories right now.
Paul Strickland, performing during the Paris Storytelling Festival May 8th through the 10th at venues including the Thoroughbred Hotel, Secretariat Park, the Wallace House Garden Club Backyard, and First Presbyterian Church, all in Paris, Kentucky. And you can find out more about the festival online at Paris Story Fest, one word, ParisStoryFest.com. Paul, thank you so much. This is really interesting. I enjoyed it.
Thank you. See y'all there.
Mandy Higgins is director of the Lexington History Museum, and she joins us from time to time to share stories of the city's past, stories that in some way inform its present. And after you listen to this conversation with Mandy, driving around Lexington will never be the same. Welcome back, Mandy.
Thanks for having me.
So our focus for this episode is a man named Lyle Ayton. Who was Lyle Ayton?
Lyle Ayton made 20th century Lexington beautiful. So he was a Navy vet who was trained at the University of Illinois as a landscape architect and was dispatched to Lexington in the early 1950s, one of the first landscape architects to show up in Lexington, and had about 60 projects over the course of his life in Lexington. He never left once he got here, including Lexington Green, the Lansdowne neighborhood, Palomar, lots of big central Kentucky projects, and worked throughout the city in planning and some other places as well.
Yeah, I'm looking at this list. It's just as long as your arm, and it would take us a long time to read it, but it is truly incredible for one individual to have such an impact on the way that a city looks.
It's incredible. And his not only the physical landscape of where the city, as you said, how the city looks, but his work on the Planning Commission also very much impacted the way the city grew. So thinking about the urban service boundary, which continues to be a hot topic in Lexington, and the ways that we view the city as this beautiful, welcoming green space, so much of that has to do with the work of Mr. Ayton. And what's incredible for us at the museum, he hand-drew a map of all of his projects across the city, and it's on display at the museum
now.
Oh,
wow. I'm looking forward to seeing that. And by the way, this also includes the Kroger Stadium.
Yes.
At UK, the Legends Stadium, reconstruction of Paris Pike from Lexington to Paris, the realignment of Main and Vine Streets downtown, a bunch of state parks. He was a busy man.
He was very busy. And he was also the director of his architectural firm.
And he taught.
And he taught at the University of Kentucky. I don't know when he slept.
And he was a marathoner and a singer.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't know when he slept.
We're very blessed that his firm sent him to Lexington in 1952, and he fell just in love with the county and with the state in the same ways that so many of us are, and that we get to benefit from the beauty he brought, particularly in those roadways, as you mentioned. Those are, you know, roads that could have been kind of neglected and forgotten, and they're beautiful today.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned the hand-drawn map. What else do you have on hand at the museum?
From Mr. Ayton?
Yes.
Yeah. So we have a portrait, the hand-drawn map, and a couple of other pieces related to him. His wife donated them after he passed, and we are just so honored to be able to tell his story. You can view that map on display Thursdays and Fridays 12 to 4 and Saturdays 10 to 4.
All right, this is Dr. Mandy Higgins, Executive Director of the Lexington History Museum, located in the Thomas Hunt Morgan House at 210 North Broadway. That's across the street from and near the Opera House in downtown Lexington. Thanks, Mandy.
Thank you.
That's Swamp from the latest album by Lexington recording artist Jim Gleason. You might recall the Johnson Brothers, the Lexington band that was built as Kentucky's Rock and Roll Repertory Orchestra. They played a lot of major events, including many a Thursday Night Live downtown. And the Johnson Brothers were known for spot-on, meticulous covers of such iconic works as the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper and White Album. Jim played guitar and sang with the band, and he has his own solo thing going on. He's out with a new album, Looking for Treble, and he's here to tell us about it. Jim Gleason, welcome back to Eastern Standard.
It's great to be back. Thanks for having me.
First of all, do you miss the Johnson Brothers?
Desperately. Yeah, I really do. It's, you know, it's rare. You know, as a player, it's rare that you get to play with people who are so good and do it for so long. And yeah, and on top of that, they're like brothers, you know. So yeah, we're still very close. We just don't play the way we used to anymore.
Well, fast forward to where we are right now. Looking for Treble, not Trouble, but Treble, is, I think, maybe your 10th solo project, correct?
It is my 10th solo project, yes.
And on it, you sample quite a wide variety of styles. Tell us about making that choice to sample different styles.
I don't know that it's particularly a choice. I've done a couple of albums where I would really dig into something specific, like the Tiki Surf album that I did, or some of the ambient stuff. But the rest of it, you know, I describe in my bio, you know, like I call myself a musical omnivore because I like everything. I'm distracted by everything, I guess is really what it is. So when I'm thinking about what to use and what to write, mostly what to write, I'm like an adventurer. I had a really interesting remark by some guy one time. He said, every time he's going on a trip, like going through the airport, he'll stop at the newsstand and he'll pick up two or three magazines that are on topics that he knows nothing about, like something about knitting, something about riflery, something about, you know, horticulture. And he said, every time you read one of those magazines, it's like going to another country. And when I dig into some of those styles, or I sort of back into some of those styles, it's that similar kind of thing. It's fun because I'm sort of a musical tourist, but it's also sort of adventurous because I have to figure out the nuances of those styles and try to get them as close as I can.
You know, I think music has always, in reality, kind of defied those categories that I guess marketers in particular have tried to shove it into.
Because, sure.
And we talk about fusion music as though that were something new, but isn't it true that all of these music genres have somehow cross paths over time, all the time?
Oh, sure, certainly they have. You know, you see those sort of trees of, you know, influences, that sort of stuff. With my stuff, it's, you know, it's not, what do you like most? It's like, I like everything, you know. And it's, when you look at an album like this, and this is not atypical of some of my stuff, a lot of them are like this, it's either adventurous in the spirit of the White Album, or it's scattershot and crazy, and it's you know, it depends on your perspective. Mm-hmm. But I like that sort of the surprises of going from track to track or album to album, even, and finding oh, I didn't know he did that kind of stuff, or where did that come from? And one of the big breakthroughs for me over the past several years, you know, starting in COVID, was starting to do ambient stuff, you know, with the Archipelago guys, because that's, you know, what do you mean there's, it doesn't matter how long the song is, and what do you mean there's no song structure, and what do you mean you can do whatever you want? I love this. Mm-hmm. Let's go. Come on. So, yeah, it seems like every time I do one of these things, a boundary or two falls away, and just keep on digging.
Are you recording in somebody's studio, or are you doing this at home?
No, I have a home studio. Uh-huh. I call it claustrophonic sound. And occasionally, I'll bring an extra musician in. Dave Hammond from the Johnson Brothers typically does drums and might fly in some keyboards. But I've had this album, Marty Walker's playing drums on it. Several people are playing drums on it, you know. So, but most of it's me. Most of it's me.
Well, let's pick a song for a quick sampling. What would you like us to play?
Your Lovely Note, I think, is the opening track on the album. And I was sort of channeling Marshall Crenshaw, actually. It's who was great at writing a lyric that you think you know where it's going, and it turns out not to be that. So maybe that's a good choice.
Look out from my window. Streetlights on a vacant street. The bus stop on the corner. The bar where we would sometimes meet. Nothing seems familiar. It might have been, but now it's not. I feel you all around me. Is that the only thing I've got? The first one up, the last one out, shrouded by the mist. It's almost like you vanished.
That's Your Lovely Note from Jim Gleason's new album, Looking for Treble. And Jim, where can we find the album?
It's up on all the streamers. It's up on Spotify and all the rest of that. You can find it on Bandcamp under my name, Jim Gleason, at Bandcamp. It's available if you're at a gig of mine. I've got CDs, but most people don't have CD players anymore. So it's almost like it's become kind of a like a door prize or a gift that I give people, you know. But it's all available for downloading and streaming.
Well, we're going to go out with another of your instrumentals from Looking for Treble. What would you like for that to be?
We could do Bird Dog.
Okay, here we go. Jim Gleason, thanks for stopping by and good luck with this new album.
Thanks so much. It's really a pleasure to be here.
Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced by WEKU and Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're on the WEKU, Apple, Spotify, and NPR apps. You can stream all of the interviews from this week's edition online at esweku.org. And while there, you can check out our contributors and their interview archives. Send thoughts and suggestions to es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard.